Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the final session on Sustainability Pathway of the GAE Conference for 2020. So far, I've had three fantastic sessions today. And before we get on to the final session with Danny Dorling, just a reminder that through our website, you can look for next year's conference. It's going to be in Guildford, where, of course, this year should have been. To go online. So, no further ado, I'll hand over to Danny, who hopefully is there for us.
Yes, I'm here. Thanks ever so much for arranging this, and thanks everybody for listening. I'm going to talk at you for between about 30 and definitely not more than 40 minutes. I'm going to show you a series of slides, and on most of the slides, there's going to be a little red dot. And that little red dot will be moving around, so it's somewhat hypnotic. Hopefully it won't send you to sleep. What I'm going to be talking about is things slowing down. And, of course, we're in a time of incredible slowdown at the moment, but I want to try to make the argument that we were already slowing down before the current crisis that we're living in, and we'll probably also be slowing down after this. And this is of great interest to geographers because it involves things like climate change, but practically everything else that human beings that matters to human beings in many ways. And the slowdown is good. So of course there's a book. The book is called Slowdown, but the subtitle of the book is The End of the Great Acceleration and Why It's Good for the Planet, the Economy and Our Lives. And I had to add that subtitle because people tend to think of slowing down as bad. We are used to thinking of speeding up as good, as acceleration as good, as economic growth as good, as travelling further and further and faster as good. But slowing down doesn't have to be bad. There's a little picture there on your screen that I hope you can see, which is of some sandcastles. And I'll show you right at the very end a picture about how to make sandcastles like that. But I'm sure, in many ways, many of the points I have to make are ridiculously easy to make now. I'm sure lots of you will be wishing now that sometime July, August, September, you could be on a beach like that. It'll be allowed, it'll be permitted. And you probably are not wishing that you could fly around the other side of the world or go to Disneyland or whatever. You're probably thinking, I'd just like to go somewhere local to Britain. That family holiday which people had abandoned in many ways in the last 10, 20, 30 years when a few of us got to a point where we could fly, that family holiday suddenly looks much more attractive than it looked some time ago. Let me begin to click forward through some of these slides. What do I mean by the great acceleration? Well, the most typical way it is shown is through this kind of a graph. These graphs are pretty misleading. They're generally presented in this way to try to scare people. So the one in the background, actually by Max Rosa, kind of looks very scientific. You know, 10,000 BCE, 8,000 BCE and so on. And then this enormous kind of increase at the end. But it's looking that way because it's a choice of how to draw it, of how to do it. But we certainly had an acceleration in our numbers. In the last 200 years, our numbers went from a billion and they doubled and doubled and have almost doubled again. That only ever happens once, really, in the lifetime of a species. It has never happened before at that kind of speed. It can never happen again unless we leave this planet and begin to live on other planets, and that is quite unlikely because they are quite a long way away and very inhospitable. So we should be looking at what we've just lived through the last couple of hundred years as unique and odd. And I'm going to try to persuade you that it's largely over. And I'm going to try and persuade you with diagrams which look like this. Now the little red dot isn't moving, so you have to imagine that little red dot is slowly moving towards the year 2020. And this is a graph of the population of an imaginary country. which starts off with 100 million people, think of Japan, and the rate of growth is 2% per year. And if you have a rate of growth which is 2% a year, which is the rate of growth the whole world had around about 1968, then by the year 2020, by now, you'd have 400 million people. And every year, more and more people would be being added to the population. It's out of control. As the text there says, Charles Darwin actually wrote about this. He wrote about this in The Origin of Species. He talked about how very, very rarely in the history of a particular species there could be a few favourable seasons when population numbers double and double and double and again. And the irony is that Charles Darwin was writing this just at the point when this was beginning to actually happen to human beings. He had no way of knowing that, but he was prescient. And the point is, these favourable seasons, we often look back and don't see them as particularly favourable, but they allowed more and more of us to be born. Most of us would not be here if the acceleration hadn't happened. These favourable seasons are relatively rare things, but we've become used to them, so used to them that we look forward and we worry massively about population of 10 billion, 12 billion, 15 billion on the planet, and we don't actually look at the deceleration that we should be thinking about, because we are in a period of deceleration. Let me show you another one of these. This, if you like, it's the opposite to what I've just shown you. This is a country, again, starting at around about 100 million people. And initially, it's accelerating, and accelerating at 2% a year. So the population is going up by 2% a year. But the next year, it only goes up by 1.9%, then 1.8%, then 1.7%. So that by 1970, 20 years on, it is not rising at all. And by 1971, it is falling by 0.1%. And it falls faster and faster and faster and faster. And the population drops from 120 million to 80 million by the year 2000 to 40 million by about 2017 to nothing around about 2070. It's a kind of children of men kind of scenario. And this particular kind of graph is called a phase diagram. It's a way of looking at not just the level of the thing that you're interested in, but also the speed of change. Now, I'm going to show you some of these kits written about, is Japan the closest real-life example? And I'll show you about Japan later, but it's nothing like this, but Japan is one of the places that is slowing down more than other places. Now, this idea of looking at the rate of change and the level, you'll be extremely familiar with at the moment, because at the moment we're obsessed by it. We're obsessed by what is the level of cases of a particular disease, and is the rate of change, the rate of increase, slowing now? So it's not that hard to talk about acceleration and deceleration at the moment, whereas normally it is quite difficult. I'm going to click forward again. I've looked at all kinds of things, and the thing which I think is interesting about all this is that the things which I thought were speeding up, I assumed that roughly half of what we were interested in was speeding up and half of it slowing down, and that's what tends to go on. The things that I thought were speeding up aren't. And the things that were slowing down are actually slowing down much faster than at least I thought they were. So I'm going to try and get you interested in this. Take student debt. Student debt is something that we think of as being out of control. At the moment in the UK, it is kind of out of control. We only raised university tuition fees to £9,000, 8 years ago? It's just 8 years ago. 8 years ago, we introduced a free market into universities. Any university who offered courses at AAB could take any number of students, but you had to pay £9,000 a year, and you could source that through debt, and the debt began to rise in the UK massively. Ironically, that free market's ended this year. No university is allowed to take a student one above or one below the number that they took last year because of the crisis. It'll be interesting whether the free market ever comes back in students. Anyway, what you're looking at there is the free market in US students. Students in the US, universities are allowed to, in a sense, take any number that they want. The students can borrow money to go. This looks like an out-of-control system. And in 2006, 2007, 2008, it was out of control. It wasn't just rising the amount of money that students were borrowing to allow them to go to university. Money they'd have to pay off later, which they could only pay off if their graduate jobs in the US paid them an absolute fortune. But they were borrowing more and more and more. The actual peak in the acceleration was July 2009. The world financial system, because of the collapse in 2008, actually couldn't lend them as easily as much money. Now, student debt carries on rising. It rises from $800 billion then, 2009, to a trillion by 2012, to 1.2 trillion by 2014. But the slope of that graph is no longer rightwards, it's leftwards. You can see that it's shifted its direction. And of course, student debt in the US cannot carry on going up forever. Nothing can. But we're living for a time, it's just 11 years ago, when the shift in the direction happened. You might be wondering, why is it peaking every October? Because students go to university in October. That's why. The data comes every quarter for this. Let me go forward, because you're probably not that interested in student debt in the US. Something else which I thought was speeding up was data, the amount of data in the world. You're constantly told that there's more and more data, more than ever before. But whenever you try to measure the amount of data, even, say, the amount of selfies that people take, which cannot carry on increasing forever. There are only so many selfies you can take yourself. You see, there comes a point where the acceleration in something which was new declines. And in the case of Wikipedia, which only began about 20 years ago, the rate of acceleration slows at 2007. Wikipedia still grew. There were more and more entries added, 2008, 2009, 2010, 11. There's a slight acceleration in 2015 again, because stubs were added, if you're interested in that, and then it slows down again. Because there's only so many interesting words you can put, you know, into Wikipedia, only so many things that people want to look up. Most of the data in the world is actually copies of other data in the world. At least Wikipedia is fairly well organised and communal. Going to click forward again. Something which actually is accelerating, which of course you know is accelerating, are carbon emissions. Here's one estimate of CO2 emissions per year from 1960. We have these estimates going back a long, long time. And you can see not only is the amount being released per year rising from, in 1970, about 10 billion tonnes a year of CO2. This is worldwide. For 1960, 10 billion tonnes, 1972, 15, 1981, 20, by the year 2000, 25 billion tonnes. By today, we were heading towards 40 billion tonnes. But what you can also see, because of the way that this figure is drawn, because you can actually see when the acceleration was most and least, is that periods like the oil shock of the 1970s, in 1974, there's actually a slight decrease. In the global recession of the very early 80s, there was a bigger decrease. In the small recession of the early 90s, there was a small decrease. 2008, we actually didn't have a decrease, but certainly the rate of acceleration slowed. And sadly, if you look at the dates of the Paris Agreement, the Kyoto Agreement, the Rio Earth Summit, every time we had a summit in the world to say how much we had to reduce emissions, we kind of took our foot off the brake. Yeah, because we thought we'd done something in the summit. So here's one thing, one of the tiny number of things, there are only four things which are actually accelerating that I managed to find when I measured all these things. And that's carbon emissions. Here's the traditional graph, the one that you and your students were used to, of carbon emissions, exactly the same data as the graph I've just shown you. But you're not seeing the nuances. You're not seeing, unless you look very carefully and can work it out, the effects of the oil shock in the 1970s, the effects of the 80s recession. What you're seeing on the normal graph is basically the change in the thing you're most interested in. And not the little wiggles in the rates of change, but the little wiggles in the rates of change are what you have to concentrate on if you want to get an idea of any slowing down which might be going on. Now, it has to be said, and of course this will almost certainly just be temporary, but by the end of January this year, emissions from China had actually dropped by a quarter. By the end of February, worldwide emissions were dropping. By the end of March, you're seeing an acceleration in worldwide emissions dropping. Nothing like this, at least in this period since 1960, that's occurred. So you can get these incredible changes. This particular pandemic, the majority of cases are in the G7 countries. because that's the country sort of able to test above anything else. Let's go forward again. Temperature. Now, more complicated than emissions, because many things affect temperature. This is a NASA series of temperature readings, and it's a NASA series of deviation globally from the 1951-1980 average. So, dates around 1951 to 1980 will be around zero. What we all know is that your global average at the moment is approaching 1 degree. So you look right at the very top at 2018, and you'll see back then it was almost 1 degree above that average. But what this particular form of graph does is get you to see that, in fact, the speed of acceleration wasn't that high during the Second World War. Because a lot of our conventional industry and consumption shut down, of course. We had rationing. We were still using factories. We were using them to make armaments. But this was worldwide. And so we get a slowdown. Then you get acceleration after that war. A slowdown again, and you'll see it again in the early 80s recession. A slowdown in the 90s recession. So the figure 1990 is to the left. And then again a slowdown in 2008. So it's economic growth, it's periods of economic growth between the recessions after the wars which are associated with the fastest increases in temperature. And because that entire graph that you're looking at is leaning towards the right, it's something which is accelerating. It's one of those rare phenomena that's actually not just increasing in the world but going up faster and faster and faster all the time. Except, I have to say it, when NASA released their figure for February 2020, it was a tenth of a degree below February 2019. Now, far too many other things affect monthly global average figures, but we're almost certainly going to see a fall in average temperature occurring this year. And it's going to make people think about what matters most. Let's go forward again. World population. The biggest underlying driver of slowdown of all. Contrast this graph with those graphs I showed at the very beginning, the kind of out-of-control cliff-edge increase. Now, this is exactly the same data. Exactly the same data. It's got 1500 on it, 1600, 1700, 1870. But you don't tend to look down into that bottom left-hand corner of the graph too much because it's such a small amount of area. You concentrate on the big swing. 1940, 1950, 1960, 1970, 1980, going to 4 billion people. Year 2000, going to 6 billion. Year 2020, almost at 8 billion. And then by 2100, possibly at 11 billion. This is the 2017 projections that the United Nations has made. They've made some last year, 2019, which are damper. Not as high as this, but the key thing is that small change doesn't matter. The key thing is that deceleration, which began around about 1968, when the curve began to move slightly, to get to a point by the 1980s, 1990s, 2010s, when we were essentially adding 80 million people a year, roughly the same absolute number of people a year, to the point that we're now approaching as we have fewer and fewer children, where we're adding less each year, and there will be a point, and it'll probably actually be before 2100, when global population ceases to rise. And I'm going to show you the same graph, but with a different scale now, because it helps highlight some different things. So this is global population from 2000 years ago to 100 years ahead, but on a log scale. And it helps just emphasise what really mattered most. And what really mattered most was 1492, the arrival of people from Eurasia into the Americas and the spread of infectious diseases, which caused the graph to buckle at that point. What matters next most was 1820 to 1850, and the thing that coincides with most clearly is colonisation, scramble for Africa, increase in the slave trade, and again, a deceleration in global growth. And then we get an acceleration again, the great acceleration of our times, the doubling and doubling and doubling again, till around now. And there you have the deceleration to come. We know it's to come because the babies have not been born. It's wired in already. And the great thing about this deceleration is it's not due to epidemic diseases, which the 1492 Americas was. It's not due to imperialism and colonialization and slavery, which the 1820-1850 was. The deceleration we're in now is due to the fact that people can choose and do choose to have fewer children. So dramatically different. And we can begin to look at this, and I promise I'll zoom through this quickly, because I'm determined not to overrun. We can look at this for every country in the world, and all you're seeing here are the figures that are agreed up to the present day, and the United Nations projections, which are probably overestimates. It probably will not grow as much. Certainly the United Nations, I would expect now, will not be as economically successful as people thought it would be. And it was the economic success of the United Nations which pulled in migrants to the USA, which led to that projected future growth that you can see after 2020, whether or not a wall is actually built with Mexico. There's the US. Each country is different. If you're wondering where's the geography in this, there's an enormous amount of geography. So the US, still rising, but decelerating population, has been decelerating since 1997. There's lots of detail on these graphs. The graphs are all on the website, by the way. It's called Slowdown. You can get them for free, and you can see all the detailed kind of commentary on them. Here's China, just to contrast with the US. And in China, you can see way back in the 1850s, 1860s, the kind of tail end of that period of colonialism. That's our gunboats in Hong Kong. That's our demanding free trade so that we could sell opium. Those are opium poppies. And you can see the population of China accelerating. After then, particularly with the time of the revolution, and accelerating again to 1968, and then the beginnings of a slowdown. Then the one-child policy, which has an effect, but not a huge effect. The average Chinese family had gone from six children to just above two before the one-child policy came in. But most importantly of all, you can see around about 2030, not very far from now, China's population peaks. And then it goes down and down and down. This is already known, but it's worth reiterating. Let me zoom faster. Here's the whole of Africa. The whole of Africa heading up to 4 billion people. Again, this may be an overestimate, as the UN updates its estimates every 2 years. Currently, it is reducing them from what it had before. And there was also fertility evidence to suggest it may be an overestimate. What is particularly interesting in terms of Africa is what happened between the 1970s and 80s and early 90s, which is when this curve should have started decelerating and didn't. And in the book I go into quite a lot of detail, but essentially structural adjustment and the IMF and denying countries funds so that teenage girls couldn't go to school had an effect on fertility, which is fairly obvious what the effect was. If you can't go to school when you're 14, 15, 16 and 17 and you can't get qualifications and you're a girl, you're more likely to have a child earlier and you're more likely to have more children overall. So everything is interlinked. But Africa, the acceleration turns into a deceleration after 2060 by the current projections. The share of the world's population in Africa will revert to what it was before the onslaught of global slavery. Let's click forward. Britain, tiny, tiny little country. This is actually Britain and the whole of Ireland all put together. And the smaller the area you look at, the more variation you see, the more the individual events matter. We're only looking at a population here that by 2100 rises to just under 90 million by these predictions. We have no idea, as you get to something as small as Britain, whether this will be true. Currently, Britain and Ireland have less than 1% of the world's adults, much less than 0.5% of the world's children. But if you're looking at the graph, you can probably see what the major events are. The biggest negative event was the Irish famine of the 1840s. Not so much the deaths, but people leaving. It's emigration. People going to America in the 1840s. Then, pandemic, 1918, and the end of the First World War just about shows up. Then you can see 1950-51. That was a little flu pandemic, much bigger than we've got now, but 51 was a significant one. And then you can see emigration in the 1980s. Auf Wiedersehen, Pet, if you can remember, going to get a job in Germany. Ruth just said, the impact of the famine is absolutely shocking. It's really interesting how this form of graphing things kind of independently forces you to produce a ranking of what matters most. And anybody from Ireland will tell you it was huge, and it's a sort of sad indictment on our English history that we don't teach very much about the famine, and the fact that we allow the famine to continue, we allow the famine to get worse. We could have stopped the famine, and we chose, I'm English, and hence I say we chose not to. And it had this incredible effect on people desperately leaving to try to live. I should say, for political balance, you can see the other fascinating effect, which is A8 migration. Around about 2003, Sweden, and one other country that I always forget, quite a small one, might be Luxembourg, I'm not sure, Belgium. But we were the big one. We opened up and invited people from the A8 countries from Eastern Europe to come. It was an invitation. We'd done it before. We did it with the Windrush generation. We went to the Caribbean and went to India, and we invited people to come. Anyway, 2003, we invited people to come, and they came. And you can see it moving out 2003, 4, 5, 6, 7 to 8, where we were getting increases. You know, this isn't huge. This is a net increase, and this includes Ireland. And remember, Ireland was having a great economic boom at this time. But increases of up to 800,000 people net a year. So people were not dying, the birth rate was pretty good, and the immigration to the whole of the British Isles was pretty healthy. Then we get the crash in 2008. That actually slows down the rate at which people came. And now we're sitting in 2020 wondering exactly what will happen. Now you can see that line going forward, the projection line, of course, is fantasy. When the reality has been skedaddling one way or another, then the idea that this is going to happen, we have no idea. Economically successful, sensible countries should see an increase in population because we already have the built infrastructure, the sewer systems and the housing for a slightly higher population. But I'll jump forward before getting myself in trouble. But the important thing, although it matters to us, we're in Britain, this is a minuscule amount of the world's population. As I said, it's 0.5% of the world's children and rapidly dropping. So interesting to us, very interesting in world history, very important in world history, less and less important, actually, in terms of the future of the world. But India. You know, if you wanted an example of a place that was influenced by this tiny speck called Britain, there's India. And you see that India began to peak. The deceleration begins in the 70s. You can see the curve begin to change. The highest absolute growth is around about the year 2000, adding about 24 million people a year. Now we've dropped already to adding 20 million a year, and India is set to peak. This is, sorry, India and Pakistan and Bangladesh added together by 2064. These things are known, it's factual. Japan, I promised. Somebody early on said about Japan. And Japan has been here before. And you can see cholera, 1822. I should say, by the way, before anybody gets very, very worried, all these past pandemics were enormous compared to this one. This current pandemic is currently and very probably smaller than the 1968 flu pandemic, if anybody can remember that, worldwide. 68 flu will almost certainly have killed more people than this one will kill. Definitely smaller than 1957 and 1951, and absolutely tiny compared to 1917, 1918. But pandemics are a big feature of these trends in the past. 1945, obviously, and the end of the war. And then a huge population boom after the war. Slows down to 1960, mini boom, which is the children of the children born after the war. And then from 1972 onwards, slow down. And since 2010, actual deceleration. And going lower and lower and lower, almost certainly. The only question is, how quickly will it get lower? That will not be about people having more children. It's almost impossible to persuade women to have more children. Men try and they fail whenever they try. Tokyo's at 1.3 babies per couple at the moment. The only way that Japan will not slow down as fast as this is if Japan allows in more immigrants than it currently allows in. Now you may be thinking, oh, countries which don't allow in many immigrants aren't likely to in the future. But, you know, imagine growing old in a country with fewer and fewer children and young people. There comes a point, and also on a planet which is going to start running out of young people, there comes a point when we're going to start competing for more of the young. And this is, of course, what happened in countries when population went down in the past. Just for completeness, the rest of Eurasia. So this is all of Europe and Asia, excluding Japan, excluding India, excluding the British Isles, and excluding China. Just to show you, I'm not fiddling this, it also slows down by 2063 and was very affected by the Second World War. And also Eurasia was quite affected by the First World War and, of course, by the pandemic in 1918. And then for completeness, Oceania, which is even smaller than Britain and even less predictable. But you can see, if you look at the detailed data at the start, you can see the effects of gold rushes and so on. It's dominated by Australia and New Zealand, but it's the whole of Oceania. Peak acceleration was 2018, has been slowing since then. A lot of this is very recent. You know, if you were to cover that up before 2008, you can see why we can only begin to talk about slowdown with confidence now. Why it's only relatively recently that it's becoming really obvious that this thing is turning, going forward again. I'm going to go through to the rest of the Americas, which are slowing much, much faster than the USA. Canada, Mexico, the whole of Latin America and South America will peak in 2061, much slower than the USA. The USA population is growing faster because it attracts migrants, because it's been economically successful. Forward again, and also because it's unequal. It's well worth saying, those countries in the rich world which attract the most migrants are those which have the highest number of jobs at the bottom that pay very little. Countries in the rich world which are very equal, like Japan, partly don't attract migrants because there aren't jobs for migrants to do. It is not simply policies and in some ways racism. It is actually, you turn up in Japan wanting a bottom-end job, you'll find that it's done by a machine, not by a human being. Going forward from the Americas to fertility. And I'm just going to show you a few of these very quickly. This is world fertility falling from 5 children per woman in 1960 to 4 by about 1976 to 3 by around about 1993. To about 2.4 now. And the graph on the right is an inset of what's happening most recently. 2015-2016, we now have data for 2017. The fall is accelerating, it's getting faster. The USA, one of the highest fertility countries in the rich world, settling around 2 children per woman. And you can see the detail on the right. Currently, at the moment, heading below 1.8. Now, this is one of the highest rates of fertility in the rich world. That the whole of the rich world is well below 2. And, of course, the portion of the world which is rich is growing because China, essentially, is now in the rich world. We do have to accept that. Let's go forward again. Here is China. And these graphs are not smooth because of manipulation. They're smooth because of such a higher population. Once you're dealing with 1 billion people, things get much, much smoother. The graph on the right shows ever so tiny rises. But, you know, from 1.6 to 1.61 to 1.62 and maybe 1.63 children. 2016 was the high point, by the way. It actually fell after that. So it's, but China is going to start running out of people. Poor countries. Let's take the poorest, one of the poorest countries in Africa, one of the highest fertility countries in Africa. This is Niger. Now here, when the graph is smooth, it is because of, well, not data manipulation, because the quality of the data is pretty poor. But Niger got up to over 7.8, almost 7.9 children per woman in the 1980s. But since year 2000, we see this absolute rapid and accelerating plummeting. Still 7.2 children per woman, but dropping faster and faster and faster each year, faster than it dropped in richer parts of the world over a century ago. The graph on the right shows you the kind of detail in the book. In the book you can put in more words, and so you can explain more, and that's the only difference. There's more text in those boxes on the right than there is on the graph on the left. Some other exceptions or places that are particularly poor. If you're wondering, East Timor shows the effects on fertility of an invading Indonesian force and the kind of how disruption and war can have an effect on this. But again, even East Timor, you're seeing a plummeting now. Guatemala, which had a whole series of civil wars, even despite them, has got down now to below 3 children per woman, and the fertility rate was falling through that. Haiti, I should say, by the way, that the graphics are drawn by my friend Kirsten. So I produce the Excel sheets, and Kirsten draws the graphics, and she's got a thing about national birds, which is why you have these various different symbols on these graphs. Haiti, since 1986, just see that drop. It's quite incredible. And there's a speeding up of knowledge around the world amongst women. You do not have to have 4 children. You do not have to have 3 children. You don't actually have to have children at all. And you have a way of controlling that. Now, that your way of controlling that is much higher in the USA and in the UK. But the knowledge is spreading faster. And access to education is spreading faster. France, hovering around 1.8. A French government that tries to encourage fertility, which, for instance, pays higher child benefit for the third child than the second, which if you're in England, you'll be surprised if you've got children, because, of course, you get no child benefit for the third level. Even France can't get the level up to 2. Somebody said, what are these graphs called? They're called phase portraits. They come from physics and maths. They're used by social scientists in Japan, but not by social scientists in Britain. And Kit, who's being very fast, has just had a go at duplicating his graphs in Gapminder and being able to plot them along to see them. Brilliant. That's great. So phase portraits is the name for them. But literally, it is just showing the rate of change on the x-axis and the absolute amount on the y-axis. The only clever thing is to work out the rate of change from the point before to the point after. That smooths the rate of change a little bit, and you get a much neater graph. That's the only clever thing I did. You know, it's remarkable being a university professor. You have to do hardly anything at all. As long as you do one thing slightly different, then you're allowed to carry on working. Let's zoom much faster. Here's the UK. And again, you can see the very fast drop in the 1960s. The pill comes about 1962, 1963. If you remember Philip Larkin, sex began in 1963. It was all too late for me. Well, it wasn't for many people in the 60s. Fertility drops. We get more knowledge of contraception. It spreads through the social classes. It was middle class at first, into 1970s. Absolutely dropped down, and then we're into the current period now, where we're choosing to have children rather than desperately trying not to have children. And in some cases, of course, desperately trying to have children and finding that we can't. But spare a thought for South Korea. South Korea, far faster plummeting down. And in fact, at the end of last year, South Korea got to a fertility rate of 0.99. First country in the world to be less than one child per couple. That's a halving of population in just a single generation in that extreme case. It's nothing to worry about. There is no problem having parts of the world where population would halve in a year, because there are enough other people in other parts of the world who can easily make up for the people in those places which are halving. And the faster that you have migration towards these areas, the faster world population will actually fall, because people who move to areas of low fertility themselves have lower numbers of children than they would have had if they hadn't moved. I'm realising that I am running out of time, so I'm afraid Portugal, just to tell you, you can see it zooming down there, and the national bird of Portugal is rather colourful. Brazil, incredible Brazil. You see the tight knot Brazil's got itself into, around about 1.6, 1.7 children for many, many, many years. And there are many complicated reasons why different countries differ. In Brazil, there was a fashion in soap operas to have small families in soap operas, which actually accelerated the decline in fertility. Other things. GDP. Here's GDP in the world. Now, if you look at it this way, you could say, well, it's accelerating, but maybe since 2006 we've seen a deceleration. But if I look at it a different way, and of course there's no saying which is the correct way necessarily, if I look at GDP on a log scale, then the actual time of greatest acceleration was the 1950s. And in the 1950s, GDP rose on average by more than the 1960s. And the 1960s were a period of greater growth than the 1970s. The 1970s were greater than the 80s. 2000, we had some pretty high growth, but then we had an almighty crash in 2008. I think if you look at it this way, you're seeing GDP growth growing from shortly after the time we actually began to measure GDP, which was measured during and after the war. The estimates from before the war are estimates. GDP for China. You have to remember, I spent years producing these graphs and put this book together just before the current crash. So I was concentrated on, you know, what was happening at the end of 2019, 2018. And the world was entering a global recession. And this is really important to remember now, because unlike previous pandemics, unlike 1968, 57, 51 or 1917, which were all pandemics during a time of acceleration, of GDP acceleration, where the pandemic had almost no effect, for the great 1917 flu pandemic, 1918 is when it mainly hit, world GDP and carbon emissions fell up by around about 14%, but then they rose the next year by 16%. It looked like a blip on the graph. This may be different this time because we are seeing GDP growth slow down quite significant even before the current circumstances. That's China for you. The NASDAQ. This is the NASDAQ up to 1996. This is stocks and shares in mainly high-tech companies. And you can see incredible acceleration. If you had money and you wanted to get rich, you put it into IBM and so on back in the 1970s and then into Apple. Let's go forward from 1996. Here's the NASDAQ after 1996, and you can see, I don't know if you can see my mouse, you may be able to, but you can see after 1999, the dot-com boom and crash, 2000, it loops round, it loops again, then it escapes, and then 2015, 16, 17, 18, 19, we have what looks like the beginning of another loop. Now, there's nothing predictive about these graphs. You can't use these graphs to actually tell you about the future in the value of stocks and shares. Ironically, you know, when I update this one, I can show you, if you can see on the screen, but you can imagine it. You're going to see the most almighty looping down as this thing absolutely crashes way down to dot-com. Incredible. It's a way of looking at the insecurity of stocks and shares and investments, which otherwise you can tend to think are more secure than they really are. Let me give you 5 minutes because I've gone over and then I will stop. So please think of questions to ask about this. World heights are not actually falling. They look like they're falling. The average human being is falling in height. It's actually that the mix of people on the planet is changing. So the countries which people tend to be the tallest in have lower fertility, so we're producing less of our tall children. As opposed to those countries which still have high fertility, people tend to be a little bit shorter. But anyway, globally, we've reached the end of human beings getting taller and taller. And certainly if you look within any country, you'll see a deceleration in the rise. So your children, if you have them, will almost certainly be taller than you on average. But their children will probably be a similar height to them or only a fraction taller than they are. And the difference between you and your parents in height is bigger because of the changes in the past are bigger than the changes now in nutrition and all other kinds of things. Here's one of the others. I told you right at the start, there are just four things which are still accelerating. Carbon emissions, which actually have stopped now. Temperature, which may have stopped accelerating now. The number of graduates in the world, and you have to try and imagine what the last one is, but the number of graduates in the world was still accelerating. It will not be now, because it includes students who go overseas, and they won't be going overseas, a lot of them, this summer. But there'll also be a slight slowdown in this idea of you go to university, you'll get a good job, you'll be rich. We will have a change in actually seeing what is most valuable, how much are we going to pay people for what they do in many, many parts of the world, not just in the West. Something which is thankfully slowing down, although it's not as good news as it seems, is species extinction. This is the rate of extinction according to the London Zoological Society records. Has been slowing down since the 80s. In the 80s we had the peak of species extinction because the very rare mammals on small islands were being wiped out. Why do I say it's not brilliant news? If it hadn't slowed down, we would have 100% extinction, not just us, but all other species. So I won't dwell on that, but it's a graph that originally you can say it's great, it's slowing down. But actually, it's something that absolutely had to slow down in it, and it kind of makes you stop and think. Towards the end of the Great Acceleration, we lived through this period of absolute incredible extinction of species, which of course is continuing, but for the large species that this records, we've gone past the peak of that, because most of the rare ones did live on small islands. So what is still speeding up? Here's the last of the four things that was still speeding up, and it's air flights. Now, hardly anybody in the world flies. The vast majority of human beings in the world have never been on an airplane, never will be on an airplane. Large numbers of people in Britain will never fly each year. There's a tiny number of us who fly normally. I think it's something like 1% of flyers make up 25% of flights was released. Anyway, we got up to 4 billion flights, over 4 billion flights per year being taken by human beings by 2017, by just a tiny proportion of people, not by half the population of the world. And importantly, 2014, 2015, 2016, 2017, it wasn't just rising, it was rising faster and faster. Now it stopped absolutely abruptly, but it won't return to this. There's many reasons it won't return. One will be fear. People will be afraid of being in the wrong part of the world. But people also learn, I think, to have holidays nearer to home. They'll learn that business meetings do not need to be face-to-face. But above all of that, flights are going to become dramatically more expensive. When airlines are flying fewer people, the cost per flight has to go up. And if flights become more expensive, there will be fewer flights. So I could be wrong. We could just have a blip and that could go up again. But I do think that will reduce. Lucy said, interesting to see short haul change at the same rate as long haul. Yes, it would. This is total flights. In terms of passengers, so it's not actually the total number of aeroplanes, it's the total number of passengers sitting on planes. And it would be interesting to look in particular at private planes. If you get bored at all at the moment, it's easy to get bored now, get out Skyscanner, they're free. There's loads of free Skyscanners. And just have a look. You can look at almost every plane that's flying around the world now. And look at how few planes are flying in Europe. Look at how many of the planes that are flying in China are purely freight, often medical equipment. And then have a look at the United States, where it's absolutely frightening how many planes are still flying in the United States. But of course, tiny compared to the number before. Right, let's begin to bring this to a close. Babies, here's another way of looking at the number of babies in the world. Peaking around about 135 million a year, probably going to fall faster than this. We're not at all sure. We will find out 9 or 10 months from now what will happen due to fertility now. And there's lots of speculation. I personally don't think we're going to get a fertility increase because of the current lockdown. But anyway, let's just wait and find out. We don't need to speculate. Life expectancy. Life expectancy in the world is slowing down. The projections from 2020 are that it will accelerate and rise. That is unlikely. This pandemic will have almost zero effect on world life expectancy, simply because the numbers of people dying are so small compared to the numbers of people who normally die each year in the world. It's a pandemic affecting the richest in the world, which is why we're so obsessed with it. But it is not a pandemic which will have a noticeable effect on world life expectancy or mortality rates around the planet as a whole. I happen to think that the current World Bank projections are silly, but the fact that we are heading to an average world life expectancy of 75 is very good news. And we make it to 80, but it's much more important what we do with our lives than desperately trying to keep a human body alive forever and ever. Let's go forward, almost at the end. I said these things were used in Japan. This is one of the examples of Japanese social scientists using them. So it's not my graph, I've actually redrawn it from a Japanese one. It's a bit complicated. We tend to have a kind of quite superior view of ourselves in England and the US. And to be honest, the longer and longer I work on these things, the more I think, actually, people in Japan and China have been ahead of us for years in the way they think about things. But because the degree of modesty is so much higher, we kind of haven't noticed. This is a graph about the suburbanization or urban central growth in Tokyo over time. And it oscillates around and around as the suburbs are built up and then the centre is built up and you get skyscrapers and so on. But the point is, it's heading towards the middle, heading towards zero, as the United States stops. Sorry, not the United States, as Tokyo stops changing that much. Tokyo is still growing in population ever so slightly due to depopulation in the rest of Japan, but essentially it's a stable world megacity. It's a low carbon megacity, it's a megacity in which hardly anybody drives, it's a very low inequality megacity, it's a low pollution megacity, it's an incredibly low crime megacity. If you want an idea about what slowdown looks like, well, it's harder to go and see Tokyo now, and maybe not a good idea if everybody does go to see it, but have a think about a life in a place like that. Here's my last graph, and I've just got one last picture, so please do think of questions. It's kind of disconcerting, this, because you can't look at the audience and kind of bully them into asking questions, so I've got to kind of do it verbally, but now's the time to start typing questions, because we're almost at the end. I said these things are called phase portraits. The classic thing they're used to describe is the movement of a pendulum. So not just its position, but whether it's going fast or slow. And when a pendulum is at its outer extreme, its speed is near to zero. It hovers for a second. When a pendulum is in the middle, it's actually going fastest, and then it goes slowly and slowly till it gets to the edge again. And because of friction, it slows down. What you get is this thing called the miraculous spiral, and that is one of the patterns that you can see with a phase portrait, and it's a pattern of slowdown. And here, hopefully, is my last slide. I'm an optimist. Things will go wrong, but I do think the slowing down of human population and the slowing down of GDP growth for good. You might say it's easy for me to think that. I'm a relatively well-off person in a well-off part of the world, but I can answer questions on that. And last thing I'll say, if you look very carefully, that's me making these castles. It takes a long time to do them. You essentially need wet sand. That's the important thing. A lot of patience, and all you do is just drip the sand slowly onto a little pile of sand. You really want to try to get lots of children to join in. It's much easier, but it's a slower way of having a holiday, and you can do it for about 8 hours, actually. There you are. And the nice thing is that the tide then just washes it away, so you're not kind of wasting the sand for anybody else. Anyway, thank you very much for that. I'm going to look at questions. So Kit has said, yes, you've got to be careful about Gapminder being CPU heady if you try and draw these. Yeah, if you Google my website and click on the cover of the slowdown book, there's a tab on the slowdown website, so just Google Danny Dorning slowdown, there's a tab called animations. Click on it, but within about 2 minutes you'll hear the fan on your computer go on, because it's going to show you 67 animated diagrams of the type I've shown here. So yeah, there is something CPU heavy about it. Yes, yeah, Simon's saying it is amazing to look at the empty skies around the UK and London compared to the USA. In a way, we're lucky in Europe. We kind of geared ourselves up, at least not to be so reliant on planes, and we were using planes at least for people rather than freight. The USA, and to an extent Australia, is the other place you can see at the moment, which has clearly become reliant on flying. And you can, you know, when they can't cut flying at a time like now, you realise that they've got a problem with that. John's saying about the protesters getting together in the US. Again, if you look at the slowdown website, just go to my website, Daniel.Dorling, click on the slowdown book. There's a tab called COVID, and the COVID tab, I've drawn these diagrams for the daily estimates of this disease in 7 countries in the world. And I spent a lot of time with epidemiologists in the last couple of weeks looking at real rates and care homes and so on. COVID is slowing down in every country in Europe now, but you're very careful about saying whether it is or not. It's slowing down in France and the UK almost simultaneously. France appears to have a higher rate because it actually measures it in care homes and we don't. It's slowing down wonderfully in Italy and Spain. In Germany, it's just about to slow and the rate is lower. Tragically, in the United States, it is not slowing. Complete mess. And the data isn't good. Ben King asks, do you think incomes are going to reduce? Depends for who. I've got graphs in the slowdown book about incomes in the United States for average full-time workers. And even for average full-time workers, they reduced in the US. Part-time workers did far better. So it's far worse in the United States than full-time workers. Incomes, the average income of the median family in this country is still below what it was in 2007. We're such an unequal country in the UK that we have sort of odd perceptions of income. I certainly think that incomes of people like me, well-paid university professor, will reduce. They will either reduce because of inflation, and we may well see inflation now. The cost of bringing in goods from abroad has to rise. And my salary certainly shouldn't, and almost certainly will not go up, and may well go down. In some US universities, staff have taken pay cuts already. In Japan, it is absolutely normal for a university not to sack people, but for everybody to take a pay cut if there's a problem. That isn't an idea that we have in this country, but it might be one worth getting. It is easier for some people to take pay cuts than ever. I was actually in a Japanese university once where everybody was not paid for 1 month. But we're very likely to see an equalisation occur. People on at the very bottom, the benefits are so low that they can't be cut any lower. People can simply only just feed themselves and house themselves. So as we see a big reduction in GDP from this, we are likely, I think, to see an equalisation. The fastest and easiest equalisation is in wealth. So the amount of money we make people pay for housing is going to come down. We find this hard to contemplate, but again, there's a graph in the book. It's just a graph of the house prices of Amsterdam, which fell in real terms for 250 years. It's not necessarily a bad thing. Amsterdam, Holland isn't a bad place to live. Let me go on. How will the current pandemic for Michael, how will it affect global fertility rates? This is a G7 pandemic. It is a pandemic which is actually largely affecting the richest countries of the world. You can look up the current rate in Turkey and the current rate in Iran, which has gone down. Madness in India, absolutely madness of a policy going on in India. But in general, for most of the world, this pandemic is hardly going to touch them. The 1968 pandemic was 1 million deaths. I was a baby then. My mum and dad can remember being so ill they couldn't get out of bed in 1968. 1 million deaths in the world, 100,000 in the US. Now, the US may be if it carries on being so badly organised, head towards that, but the world as a whole, almost certainly not 1 million. So we shouldn't expect, I think, much effect on global fertility from this. What affects global fertility the most is, put it very crudely, when people have nothing else to do, if you lock them up in refugee camps, or the example nearest to us is the Gaza Strip, fertility rises. If security, social security falls, if people worry about their future, they have on average a few more children because they're more likely to have a child who will survive, who will look after them in old age. They may not think about it at the front of their mind, but possibly at the back of their mind, they do. And it's a way of achieving things when you can't achieve things other way. But I partly don't think, because this pandemic has most affected some of the richest countries of the world, those able to test, so they know they're affected, with some of the lowest fertility rates in the world, Italy and Spain, 1.3, 1.4, I don't think so. Kit said, seems some visualisations from climatologists. Oh, that's very kind. You like these as well. I quite like them. Can I post a link to the slowdown graph? Very good point. I shall try and do that now. You'll see how slow I am at this. But I'm going to copy it, even though it's very short, but you need to get it right. So here comes the link. So if you just click on that, and then if you really want to slow your computer down, click on the animations tab and you'll see what I mean. I thought that the slides I was just showing you now were going to animate, but thankfully they didn't, because I was slow enough. Whereas if the little dot had actually been moving, it would have slowed down how fast I was speaking. Darren There are many advocates for introducing a free four-day week as the slowdown in the world continues. Do you think that will happen? Yes, if we argue for it, and it has in some places and not others in some ways. So, countries which I think of as advanced, like I say Japan, but also Finland and in a way in Europe, France, have retirement ages which are earlier. You know, 62, 63, at latest 65. But nobody in their right mind would think of forcing you to work until 67 or 70. They start off later. They have people in education for longer before they begin. But then there's a question about the working week. If you go to Holland, you'll find that people tend to stop working halfway through Friday. It's a 4.5 hour week, 4.5 day week. So it's where it's argued for. And when it isn't argued for, such as in the USA, where many people can have 2, 3, or 4 jobs and are working incredible numbers of hours, it's just silly. It won't happen, though, without people actually arguing and advocating for it. But, you know, you're learning, it's hard to work at home, so, you know, the amount of time you can work now, and it's tiring and exhausting. One thing we've all been discovering is how much we actually rely on things that we normally complain about, about our work. You know, that commute that you hated, actually compared not to being allowed to commute, is tricky. I won't digress any further. Yes, Kit's saying about the planes in the US. There's going to be a really quick change about attitude to the United States, I think, which I would have wished we'd had much earlier, but I think we're just going to look at how things are arranged in the US and the rest of the world is not going to be impressed. Thanks, Simon, for that comment. Paul, how quickly will governments understand this slowdown? And will it be seen as negative from business? Some business will see it as negative, but I think clever business will look at, what do you do in an era of slowdown? What do you do when your markets are going to get smaller, when there are less and less young people, when they're less naive? And the answer, very crudely, is you stop trying to sell them Coca-Cola, which was a massive success while you had ever-growing numbers of children to sell Coke, and you start selling people things like a high-quality coat that will last them 10 or 15 years, rather than clothing that will last them for a short amount of time. You worry about quality much more than quantity, and you think of your business as not something that you're going to try and grow to be bigger and bigger and bigger forever, as that was possible, although it didn't happen in the majority of cases of most businesses in the past, but becomes almost impossible. With slowdown, Helen says, will governments ever stop using GDP to measure growth success and start to use other indicators based on quality of life, because economists and capitalists still rule the world? We've only been using it really since 1945, 1946. Keynes kind of introduced the idea in the 1930s. We've got to remember it's not been that long that we've used this, and we partly became enamoured with GDP because of a global recession in the 1930s and mass unemployment, which is the biggest problem that we fought at that time. I am very optimistic about how things will change. I think we tend to form our political views as teenagers, and we tend to very much stick with them, and that causes a stickiness about how fast things move. But if we think about the political views of most teenagers now, certainly in Britain, what they're concerned about are things like mental health and the environment. They're not concerned about GDP growth and becoming richer. As that group gets older, we will begin to see a change. You do see other changes that do happen occasionally to people. I did, as an eternal optimist, but you've got to remember it's a life-changing event. You know, our Prime Minister has faced the worst health crisis of his personal life. When that happens to people, it changes them. Anyway, I'm an optimist, but if you think about what Boris said when he came out for hospital and how he used the word love 3 times, you never know. And if anything should change a kind of way of thinking about things, watching what happens when you do slow down really rapidly does actually make you work out what you value the most. Simon saying, I read that the US government has also made continuing to fly most flights, even if empty. Oh, yes, it's crazy. No, I read that as well. If you don't fly, you lose your slot. Thanks, Ben. And thanks, Helen. yes, New Zealand priorities and well-being. And also, it's worth looking at which countries handle this particular crisis the best. New Zealand has a tiny number of deaths and has the growth in cases under control. Hong Kong, the latest case is actually somebody who flew in from Britain. And Finland have actually been holding stocks of masks since the 1950s. Finland is a place that's slowed down quite a lot, which is planning to be carbon neutral by 2035? You know, which has the lowest infant mortality rate in the world, measured a few years ago. And so we have this plethora of countries, and there may be a connection between the ones that are slower and this pandemic, apart from many other measures. Kit asked, I need to clarify, is it because in level 1-2 countries things like COVID are endemic, so it won't impact their usual trends? No, COVID is utterly and completely new. So we know that, as far as I'm a geographer like you, so you've got to be careful. But for my public health and epidemiology friends, the genes of it show that it is completely new in human populations from earliest October, maybe November last year. So it's not endemic anywhere. But only rich countries have the ability to test for it. And it also spread. I've had a paper rejected now from 4 journals in the last 2 weeks, but we may get into a fifth. Looking at the initial spread in China, COVID spread by what are called entrepreneurs in China. So a class of business people who move between cities fit the spread of it, not from actually the festival. And COVID spread out of China by business people, and COVID spread by tourists in the Alps and people going skiing, and COVID rates were highest in London and Kensington and Chelsea, first of all, a bit like swine flu when it came. So the high rate of spreading in New York was the favoured destination of Chinese tourists and so on. People who fly spread infectious diseases nowadays the most, and it is the well-off who fly. So there was an early warning for places that were not so well connected with such a frequency of flights. Endemic, this is the question everybody is now asking. If COVID has got into half of the care homes of Britain, it can only have done that through the care workers, most likely, which requires enough care workers to have had COVID, which requires their children to probably have had it, to spread it to them. And so it may well be much more widespread than we think it is, which would be very good news if it is. I won't go much further than that, but people who work in geography departments have been spending a lot of time at the moment working out things like average household size in Italy and Spain, and what's happening in different parts of Switzerland. The rate of infection is much higher in the Italian-speaking parts of Switzerland and the French part, and that's higher than the German part. Looking at the rate of household density in the West Midlands and London, and the rates by ethnicity in this, but also trying to work out, because most coronaviruses do spread with very few symptoms amongst children and young people. And then the question, at what point do they spread to the elderly who are most at risk? So it'll all has to become out and obvious in the next few weeks, because there are so many people looking all at the same time. Thank you, Simon, for the New Zealand wellbeing approach. I think I'm almost over time. Kit's talking about Malawi. By the way, if you want to look, really good news about COVID are the very low rates of mortality in the hot, rich countries of the Middle East. Anyway, nothing more on that. I'm an optimist, so I should be careful about being optimistic. Thanks, Dan. Thanks, Helen, for about the sandcastles. Yes, it looks like calcium carbonate formations in Mona Lake in North America. Yet, the kind of sand matters. So for any physical geographers who feel feeling cheated, we're very lucky in Britain. We have the right kind of sand in enough places to make these kind of sandcastles. So you don't need to fly somewhere else in the world to do them. Kit's saying, yes, so you're using virtual quotes for endemic. That means there's another seeds to go with all the others. It's fascinating what is happening. If you're fascinated by data about the pandemic, on Tuesday at 10:30, ONS will release the weekly death data. just Google Weekly Dev Data ONS, and that is the best information we're going to get since last Tuesday, which is the first time we got to see the real spread into care homes. Thank you, Jenny. Thank you, Helen, for more about the sandcastles. Good plan for Sam off, and well worth reading Kate Walworth's Donut Economics. Yes, it is. Kate, I think, is holed up here in Oxford as well. Thanks, Lucy. Thanks, Kit. Sandcastle building decelerating. Yes, Simon, yeah, I think you're right. And you mentioned Shotover earlier. We do need to accelerate it, but I should end on this. If you don't know, Shotover's a hill in Oxford. And I grew up in Oxford. When I was a child in the early 1970s, we used to go to the top of Shotover, and there was a thing called a sand pit in which you could make sandcastles. And slowly over time, the sand has washed away from the sand pit. And what we really need, if anybody wants to plan with me how quietly to do this, is for somebody to take up a whole lorry load of sand, several tons, and dump it into the top of the sand pit. Simon, we can come to deal with this. On the hill in Shotover, so that in it's got a stream that goes through this sand pit, by the way, so that future generations of children can make sandcastles on the top of Shotover and don't need to think necessarily of even having to go as far as the beach to have a nice rest. Thank you, everybody, for listening to me. That's an hour and 10 minutes, so far too long. Many people are typing, but I'm going to say have a great rest of your weekend. Have a rest. Please try to remember it's still the weekend. It's one way of keeping sane. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Danny. And an hour and 10 minutes was nowhere near enough, actually. For ages. It was so interesting. The connectivity was interesting. It connects everything.
Thank you ever so much. It was great to be on. It's nice to get to talk to an audience for once. I was missing that quite a bit.